an enviable spot to try to follow the last one. Okay, this is a poem called The Poet Who Watched the Plaster Dry. It's a true story. The poet who watched the plaster dry stayed out of sunlight in East Clare. A missions man told to ready the house for his brother-in-law. He was not one for superficial greeting. The knock came to the door. Brian Mooney would go to the door and pull arms and eyes into the room. He was never one to let go of a plasterer. Sure hadn't he had need of a score or more before he left the burrow. The cup of tea came out, used to cement the relationship, bind Brian to his guest. How much tannin had Mooney disposed of, gathering people around him so he could watch the plaster dry. Never one for the empty cup or the half-formed phrase. Our host lingers. He watches the proceedings, the minute slap of sponge on stone, the mixing up, the grit of it all. Such a poet is ever desperate for new material. He'll stay in all day, practicing Proust, absorbing the scent of pheromones. An alcoholic lingers for the sake of a way to be less lonely, as does a cobra, as does a characterized face from beyond, who loves the company of men with trowels and the invisible evaporation of life's oil one Saturday in Atlantis. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Paul. And next up we have Donna Coogan.
My list is short. Got home late. Why? Well, we broke up around 10. Along the way home, I decided to shop rather than stop and interrupt the next day, saving myself from distraction. Besides, Tesco at night is empty and quiet, and I like it. As I cruise and choose, lift and replace, pinch and turn over, select from the back, check the dates. My list is short, fruit and chocolate. I grew up in Dublin, and my father was a very proud corpsman who died, unfortunately, when I was 19. So I grew up knowing all about Cork. So I'm going to read a poem about my father, and it's quite magical for me to be in a pub in Cork, reading a poem about my father. My dad, a small wiry Cork man with a passion for life and a gift of the gab that drew people to him for advice and company and laughs. Me being the youngest, my dad always looks the same to me, the same amount of hair, a white strip like Velcro around a smooth, bald head. The same hat, the same coat that would have hung in the hall and would have hung there forever after he was gone, except the house fire faded. Was it the same suit? I can't picture him wearing anything else. The hat, the suit, the cigarette in between his fingers, the neck inclined forward, just like my brother, just like my son. He told me about his life, him being the youngest of five, only in his teens when his parents died. Stories of his college days in UCC, his love letters to my mother, card games and getting butter from the Kerry pal. That pal who moved to the same road in Dublin, his job with the revenue, catching smugglers, and bridge classes he gave, his love of birds, we two watching above a sentry line of medicine bottles in the breakfast room window as he named Cardo, Blackbird, Wren, his health problems and heart diet, his Cork pride. Now I live in his Cork, where there is so much of my life that he has never known.
This is called Sweat Lodge. I am held by entwining branches, the sun warm on my back. I move up higher, push into a cavity of leaves, start to strip the bark. A work of preparation, each group a different task, all of us fasting. Some bend cut branches into shape, fashioning the skeleton of a yurt. Others search the stones that must be round and flat to heave into the flames that settle in a hollow on the ground. Still more roll out sheets of black tarpaulin to close the frame of wood. We are the moth gatherers. We cover all with lichen. By the torrent, some are drumming, some are dancing, others singing. As the chant grows louder, we fall under its spell. Men move in an outer circle, women form their own within. We disrobe and are the first to file into the makeshift tent. A woman wise in tribal lore leads us into darkness. Her incantation thrills me. She sprinkles water on the burning stones. The blast dries up my throat as we hunker on the ground, wedged between two others. I start to bake like bread until the pores release and sweat crawls down my limbs. The healer calls for courage to help us to endure. The men outside keep chanting to give us strength and hope as we gulp the blistering heat. We huddle in the moonlight space, slippery and speechless. But when I follow others and walk into the outside world, I'm dazzled by the daylight. I stumble to the waterfall and plunge into its foam. The icy liquid stops my breath and pins me to the rock. Surfacing, I lie upon my back to let the swirling motion carry me along. Never so wide with wonder, never so cleansed and clean, I wake up to the now. Thank you.
Proof that persistent nagging gets you what you want. Billy Ranch.
Hello.
Hey, Billy.
I could have sworn that was him the other night. Half cut and ancient in a pillar of lamplight, his shriveled face twitching beneath his trilby, as he gawped at the girls squabbling and vomiting in the alleys behind the nightclub. Why did I blacken so many pages, so many grey, unyielding squares, he must have thought, as he listened to the couple rotting in the closed-down chip shop's doorway. Why did I lend my best years to the silence? He shuffled through the four-star pizza queue, sidestepped an embryonic, drunken kerfuffle, and mooched into the solidifying mist that spangled his glasses, his oversized 20s raincoat of no particular color. My windows are thin as the flimsiest copy paper. They cannot preserve the silences that flourish when our mouths connect from the teeming hubbub of the clubbers disgorged into Hanover Street. I hear the girls keening theatrically, vodka sobbing, and the slap-happy banter of the check-shirted boy. There's the sound of a schoolyard of frustration. I listen for the rage in their brittle hilarity. Her body beside me is white as can be, imagined in this city of stains. As Prague after snowfall on a Czech dusk in November, she is unblemished as the empty page.
I thanked him for one part of that poem, and we got the two, so doing all right. Next up is Miriam Q.
They are forgiven, and whose sins you shall retain, they are retained. The Freedom Five marched prisoner. Prisoner kept between the walls to try to keep his balance. He was blindfolded. He didn't see the approaching steps and fell to the ground. The boy paid no heed to his cries and the blood on his face and knees. They dragged him to the thorn bush. It was time for prisoner to make his daily confession. The boys stood close together, so no one could see. Prisoner knelt before an unusually large and well-established road bush. One of the group interrogated him. Name, prisoner. Before he could prevent himself, the kneeling boy moaned Jack. Without warning, another from the group rammed a thorn branch into his head as they cried in unison. Liar! Prisoner has no name! One removed the blindfold and thorn branch, and without a second look, they departed, leaving the boy crying in agony on the ground. Help me, he moaned. When he could cry no more, Jack lay motionless. Within his pain, he heard a voice calling him from ever so far away. It's not that bad, Jack. Honestly, I could help you. Jack smiled and felt happy as he breathed his last. You should arrange me for a mate. And Jack, being a deeply disturbed young man, was buried with the minimum of fuss. There was talk of a guard of honour from the school, but somehow that never materialised. A prayer was said to Jack's morning assembly, and then everything continued as normal. A party was held by the Freedom Five to rejoice and congratulate themselves over Jack's demise. Jack's family moved to another town, and no one really missed him, as they'd always kept to themselves. A month later, the class teacher heard a surprise for the Freedom Five. As soon as he entered, a sudden hush descended upon everyone. He had in his company the smallest and slightest boy that he had ever seen. His hair was jet black and fell to his shoulders. His skin was as pale as the moon, and his eyes seemed half shut. Class began to teach him nervously, meet her new pupil, Mortimer Maggot. A burst of laughter came from the boys, which was quickly curbed when the teacher's fist banged on the desk for silence. Everyone stared at Mortimer Maggot. He smiled around to everyone and seemed totally at ease. The Freedom Five exchanged grins. There was going to be more fun and games at break time.
During the course of the morning, they found out that the new boy excelled at mathematics and history. The bell rang for break, which reminded his friends with Mortimer the class teacher departed. The three and five quickly eased their way to front the task for Mortimer's back. They surrounded him. Victor, one of the boys, was on the point of looking for lights in Mortimer's hair, when a strong scent of roses invaded the room. The group stood back a pace, looking at each other in a faintly troubled fashion. Then Mortimer smiled and reached out to touch one of the boy's hands. "Hello," he said, in the softest, most sing-song voice imaginable. "You must be my new friend. Call me Morty. Why, already I'm half in love with you." The boy froze in horror. There was an unmistakably relaxed gleam in Mortimer's eyes, and there was not even the slightest suggestion of fear. The Freedom Five spent the whole day in a state of confusion. At last the bell rang for home time, a chance to get away, a chance to get away from the presence of Mortimer Maggot. Victor ran out the door as soon as class was dismissed. He touched the little present that Mortimer called in his right hand. What could it be? Victor remembered the knowing smile of Mortimer as he delivered it and felt terrified. He had to open it, he couldn't take it home with him. In agitation, he opened the bundle, and out fell the biggest and sharpest thorn that he'd ever seen. His mind was playing tricks on him. He couldn't be. He didn't see the truck coming towards him. The last thing that Victor knew before losing consciousness was Mortimer leaning over and laughing, while a paramedic muttered to himself, "Those legs are a mess, he never walks again." Over the course of the next few days, similar bundles were distributed to the remains of the Freedom Five, and different traumas were faced by them. Wayne's face was permanently disfigured. Sean lost the use of his right hand. Melvin was blinded, and now found out that he was suffering from a terminal disease. The following Monday, the principal announced that there would be no more of Mortimer Maggot at St. George's. He'd won an exclusive scholarship to Masters, and even at this moment in time, he was most likely settling into his new class. A short prayer was recited for the special intentions of everyone. Thank you.
A very short story called Diving for the Keys. John Menahan leaned on the stern rail of the old launch moored along the quay at Killaloe. He said, "What do you ask? Let's go up to Kate's for a pint." "I know, Johnny, we're cooking the grub. See you later," said Des Moran, sticking his head up from the hatch of his boat, which was moored behind Menahan's launch. "Here, take my car. I need the walk," said Des. He threw his car keys over to Johnny, who put his hand up to catch them, but missed. "Shit," exclaimed Johnny. It was just a little spreading ring to indicate where the keys were on their way to the bottom of the Shannon. "Ah, Jason, shoot the right Amadon," said Des. "No problem," Jim O'Brien interjected. "Sure hasn't he been telling us all about his old hard half-diver suit and all the great work he's been doing inspecting the jetties on the Shannon?" Needled into the challenge, Johnny agreed to search the keys. 20 minutes later, the air compressing equipment was running, and Johnny was cumbersomely lowering himself down the ladder on the stern of the launch, the big copper helmet submerging under murky water. Des had switched on the intercom in the wheelhouse of the launch, and was soon instructing Johnny. "Stay in one place. Shine your torch around. Don't move around, you'll stir up the mud." "Ah, fuck off. Don't be telling me how to do my job," was the reply that crackled over the intercom. "Anyway, the mud is fucking stirred up already." Des Moran winked at Jim O'Brien and put the instrument up to full volume. "Come on, I need those keys. Find the feckers, Menahan." Des was not a bit put out by the threat that he would get his teeth knocked right out through his arse if he didn't shut up. A mother covered her offspring's ears. Sightseers started to appear as the air turned blue with salty language blaring out from the intercom. Des kept needling Johnny over the intercom to see just how many choice phrases he could draw out onto the by now very public broadcasting system. "Sure, for fuck's sake," came the complaint from the murky depths of the Shannon. "I'm doing my best. It's like looking for a needle in a pint of porter. And that's what we badly need, pints of porter. Come on, use your hand. Feel around for those second keys. You know shagging youth at all. The reply that came was unprincipled. Loud cheers and laughter from the gathering crowd of spectators greeted this supreme example of imaginative rivalry. What was that, Johnny asked? Oh, you're on air, Johnny. You're the star of the new Killaloo Broadcasting Corporation, replied Des on the intercom. The car keys were never found, but a good time was had by all. Even Johnny's blood pressure returned to normal quickly, once they were all ensconced in Katie's pub. Then, Des produced the spare keys from his pocket. Thank you.
Newspapers about the whole situation, we're ending up with a glass city seemingly. Anyway, called fire. I missed the opera house by a head, too young by a foot. It would have been a boat, but the bones pressed home. And when the coast cleared, there would again be more fires to those. Then came Sutton's on the Mallet. New spread like wildfire, and we hosed down there. Witnessed the fall of Victorian grandeur and the eventful rise of new brutalism that fed the eager fire of draftsmen. The best of the draft horses had thrown their last load at. There were clean streets then and nice shiny windows reflecting a new vision. Down the road of glass we went without slipping, the dribbling back to the new opulence that no one could see through, until devastating fires blew hard and enveloped the city with a new sense of importance. Now, a cold wind blows down the bridges to the quays. Someone will procure the key to lock the ships out and quench the history of the city. These people, who are these?
Next up we have Mr. Plagiarizer. Throughout the screen.
Thanks very much. It's another letter from Carl, all your insults. I welcome them all. No. This is another letter from Maisie Gona. She's teaching in a wild savage school and she's it's beginning to wear her down, and she's beginning to side with them, I think, anyway. Dear Principal, I'm here now with 5A. They are one of my favourite classes. They are so quiet. Admittedly, all the smoke in the air makes me feel quite high sometimes, but there's not an ounce of badness in any of these boys. There's more than an ounce of certain substances under the desk, I suspect, but that's all. There's always such an air of blissful calm in the class that I really wish the government would consider legalising cannabis. It's better than having to deal with cannibals, that's what I say. I only wish I were teaching them English so I could do Tennyson's song of the Lotus Eater with them. But I suppose I could always try something like Baudelaire or Rambo. The last time I mentioned absinthe, they thought it was when a pupil wasn't present. I said to them that I suppose when you took absinthe, they were in a sense not present, but they didn't get it, so I let that go. The pupils were immediately interested when I first mentioned Rambo, but when they discovered I was not in fact referring to Rambo, they lost interest. Now that everyone is snoozing quietly here, some pupils sitting on the floor, lounging against the walls, and one or two in lotus-type positions, I am afforded an opportunity to continue with the parent-teacher meeting files. Several parents at the meeting yesterday asked me about the forthcoming musical. Being in the school gym at the time, the sight of the stage put them in mind a bit. I knew we shouldn't have held the meeting there, it's only encouraging them. But there's nothing can be done about that. After they had seen Mr. Johnson send his son Jay sprawling across the stage, the cat was out of the bag. I think you see some of them thought they were interrupting rehearsals for the show. Some thought it was Oliver, and the scene where Oliver is being hauled about a year around the orphanage. They didn't realize it was for real. I got some of the children to start humming, Boy for Sale, in an effort to cover things up. Some parents, on seeing him climbing up the rope and sitting on the top bar, were thinking of the Pirates of Penzance. I myself was hoping that we might go up for Sweeney Todd, the musical. This would be an ideal opportunity to get rid of a few unwanted pupils. Or The Hate in the Opera with Mac the Knife. 6M have a marvellous range of knives that would be ideal for such a production. Well, that's all for now, Principal. Some of the pupils are humming now through the smoke. The hills are alive with the sound of music. Remember, Principal, to climb every mountain and don't forget the binoculars. I think the smoke from the pupils' joints is having an effect on me. I feel lightheaded somehow. Must fly. Yours euphorically.
Okay, this is called Apples. The serpent distributes apples with deftness of experience. He'd worked with this meat in the market before. Everyone sells themselves at the end of the day, he said, shedding another skin to show most innocent sheen of flesh. I live in your imagination, he hissed, but it came out as a whisper. I live in your dreams, he whispered, but it came out in a hiss. He was beautiful, of that there was no doubt. His seven faces changed, depending on which angle, but the wind never caught up with him, his body moving with the silken snake slither of sand over stone. And knowing his form, she took his gifts anyway, grumbling as soon as it was her having to take the blame again. Adam's voice was heard ring, an echo in the distance, but not by her. His words were a stool to a throne compared to what she glimpsed in the river. The red apple in her hand rippled as the breeze blew over the water, her red cheeks grew crimson, apple skin broken. This is called Tap the Window. When only your shadow will walk with you home, when you can hear the night's breath but not catch your own, when doctors can't find what it is your blood lacks, when all of your feelings are spiders with cracks, when all suggesting your heels, your shoes catching on stone, when you're the ballerina in box that spins on its own, when you can no longer tell if you're hungry or full, when you've chosen the curtain before play is through, when memories playing their silent movie scream from their set, when you don't want to remember but you cannot forget, when most people smoke up from a cup that's so bitter, when communications were shouted from one person called up to another's banisters, when you go out to bars to break the bars down, when you know if you walk under the blackbridge you'll never be found, when you're so invisible ghosts could walk straight through you, when mirrors won't let you be the person you want to, when even your shoes no longer fit, you're unsteady, when the whole sky changes before you are ready, when a flock of birds scatter having taken fright, when your voice shatters frosted glass of the night. Just remember, some may still dream of you, and they're the ones who are truly sad to you, if you'd have met their gaze, not cut the silvery thread, one between you. Just remember, some may still dream of you, and they're the ones who have truly seen you, where you are unwound, your ghostly selves, more free, more profound, you've taken up space in their cells, and not just the sidewalk. Just remember, some may still dream of you, and they're the ones who have truly heard you, in a place without lines, where colours run into each other. They have felt the pulse beat in your eyes. They are the ones who've taken you aside, whose walls you've walked through, to settle beside the hearth of their bedchamber. and you tap at their window, unaware that you have already found a place there.
I'd like to interrupt proceedings to wish Frieda a happy birthday and hope you'll join me in singing happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Frieda. Happy birthday to you.
And next we have Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, guys. What follows is my attempt at an occasional poem, mainly the New Year, and this was written in 1993. I don't want to pick it out, but I did. So this is called Pull Up for the New Year. New style, effective for a while. And years and years and years of gears in the single mesh. Cage and braided put in years and years and years of artificial engines in an old blood analysis. Halting at the wrong time of testing what we think is best. The goddess stews in old candle light, and the crowing in the eyes of sweet has fallen and shattered. You sent from the barrack, reinstating the bore of nothing to do and almost every twist in the face. An angle from the armlet, the wavelength is drowned. And rebels up to lead it, but the bells they have foretold, I have been very, very bold. Tweeting from shores, and every weeping and its claws, and consequences in the dark fall from the softness in cold walls, as parents once stand in the mist, and a crisis all over the sea, more of the sisters will break for its own worth of sake. Thanks. I think I'm going to call along or reach out the email. I wish you were here. Terror and immorality now share the same house together. Next door, they see that we come to no harm. I wish you were here. Even spirited, well watched, with a hidden aim in mind, hidden even away from ourselves. I feel antisocial, crippled, weak. My wish was to grant at the wrong time, when the men passed by with waste years. Books are on the dressing table, I can consult them, and they make it sound so easy. It happened once you looked everywhere. I wish you were here. Terror and immorality drop by on the way to see if I'm alright. Next door, there's no fear of them coming any harm. I wish you were here. Level-headed, steady-hearted, with boys here inside. Thanks.
Patricia. Next, we have...
last round.
I'm Coppel Jarga. Oh, last round. Incidentally. And next, we have I'm Coppel Jarga.
John Waters of the Irish Times. Complained some time back that we're not celebrating our diaspora enough. And I must have been sleeping on this one for a while. Because my great-great-grandfather put 12 of his 14 children on the boat, mainly to the United States, during the famine and for some years after that. So it's like your reference to how things hit us when we get up and write something down. I woke in the middle of the night and this was in my head. And I've called it Type She, which is the Irish for ghosts, as some of you sneakers would know. And I'm only gonna read two verses of a very long poem. There's loads and loads and loads of ghosts in it. I'm aware that a certain ghost of Ocasic admonished me last week and we started going on and on and on, so I just read the first two verses, which says the same. She. Cold iron thoughts being furnaced into fiery steel, ghosts of my father's fathers and all our land generations, pummeling my sleepless nights until screaming I am driven to implant on the printed page searing histories that pain me. The madding chronicler ink cannot dry quick enough as torrents of turbulent terror pour forth to relieve the torment that twists and turns this teaching traumatizing yet unbridled releasing the guilt burden of my people, the great Gaelic genocide of my past, has haunted, harried, and harassed into my seed generations, and now lies strewn in diasporatic tatters throughout nations. Verse 2. Children wailing on the quarter decks of creaking coffin ships, gaunt shawled emaciated child mothers, raw bones clinging to their womb fruit, famished and malnutritioned, with bellies emptied of straw, grass and roots, clawed from the parting quayside long mile acre, while fat wheat bellied ballasted boats fight at the same self-key wall for enough high water to quit the crusted land that they have raped and plundered to satiate dancing lords and leaping ladies in great houses to the east, pirouetting to minuets and soft-stringed waltzes, be damned, oblivious to the wanton waste that carries their great fortunes away from the scorched green earth and the ghosts of my father's fathers. With your permission, Mr. Cossack, one short one.
Yeah,
one short one.
We're running out. We've got
just
a few more
questions. Sorry.
Okay. How long?
Very short. Just okay. Show it a sense of humor. It's a little caught cameo. It's a joke error, but I put it to it first. Hannah Batten. Nelly and Hannah Batten were having the year on a cold winter's morning when the film called here. Hannah picked up a callus all wrinkled and pink. This reminds you of my fellas. What do you think? How do you mean, girl? Is it late? Don't be the disgusting girl. That's all wrinkled and bent. What do you mean the thickness? All fleshy and full. God forgive you, girl. He's a man, not a bull. Well, what do you mean, Jordan? For once and for all? The dust of it, Nelly. That's all.
This one just before I read the poem, just some of the character in the poem is Tamerlan. He's a nomadic warrior conqueror in Central Asia in the 14th century. And he conquered vast areas of Central Asia, and he was basically a follow on from the likes of Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan. And his capital was in Samarkand. It's a city that still exists in Central Asia, somewhere in one of the old Russian republics. thought instead I'd just say that before I read the poem. And the poem is called A Narrative Poem About the History of the World. And it's got a little prologue. Prologue runs, 250,000 American and British troops in oil-rich Iraq, post-colonial Mayari. From Samarkand, the gathering horde drove on, across unhindering plains, heavily armored men on horseback, followed by a cabal of slaves. The year is 1381. What motivated Tamerlan now drives me on to reconstruct his mind. Not religious fervor or altruism, but selfish thought. He donned his suit and left the city that he built to save insatiable greed. Can anyone believe his primal thoughts were human good? A black king of a great empire once stood, four square before the peoples of the earth, and dreamed of Tamerlan and Samarkand, and never wrote it in his book.
My senses
started spinning round, my heart began to pound and pound, my feet were lifting off the ground, I was leaving my body and I'd never be found. Smoke was spiraling up my nose and making its way down to my toes. I was like a chimney wearing clothes. Mother Earth was rotating quick, my guts were asking to be sick. This was worse than evil sick. My eyes were rolling in their sockets, I was glowing like a Russian rocket. The cigarette guard said, suck it, suck it, and I was thinking, fuck it. I was no longer leaned against the wall. I was on my knees. I tried to crawl, and I collapsed in a coughing sprawl. But in the throes of this damnation, I kneeled again. The new sensation. The transformation, the sheer elation, exhilaration, jubilation, beyond my wildest expectation. No hallucination. This was better than masturbation. They got stuck their education. I found my station. That's the story, how it all started, and ever since then, we've never been parted. Whatever the occasion, I'm never seen without my good friend, Nicotine. With bewildering beauty from that very first day, I need you to take my breath away. Oh, thank you very much. And now we have the magnificent Alan Kitchen.
Very short after that, I'm afraid. I noticed when we were congratulating Breed that nobody brought in the cake with 21 candles on it. I was never good at math. Okay, and when Joe was talking about what's that story? Sound of Music. I always thought Sound of Music is the only film where you really want the Nazis to win. We think about it. Sorry. The sonnet, one short sonnet called Foreign Wars, which has to do with all the soldiers from Western imperialist countries who go out and try to bring civilization to lesser breeds without the law. But it's a sonnet, so you can hear it. Foreign Wars. Mostly they speak of wars and of their justification, and why this time all the fine young men will come home to their loving families and neighbours and will resume their lives and laugh, and then never talk about what happened out there in the hot countries where women and camels were expendable, and exactly in that order. They never ask what got them into this camel in the first place, just luck or adventure, an escape from the boring world of work and the endless fucking stream of life whose flow and ebb and tide and rush ends as it always does for those who love their coffins. They die, but never talk of those whom they have killed, the anonymous, expendable opium of the tinning fields.
Downstairs isn't well shouting yet. I'm going to try to give you a very, very quick one.
Nothing pissed on the girl.
It showed up after his leaving, arrived with as much unexpectedness, and mornings now sits in the place where he sat, across from her at the breakfast table, but had never poured coffee or opened the newspaper as he would. All day, as he was, it is hardly from her side. Even before dark, follows her out to fetch coal, but does not, as he did, carry the bucket inside. And each night it comes into the bed with her, sleeps beside her as he slept, yet gives no kiss to her cheek, turns up then in her dreams as he did.
Crayley next. And we'll
see
you
next week. Never ending stream of pop and poesy.
I don't know. What about it, Alan?
Hey,
Paul, if I do it. I mean, you haven't come up shouting yet.
We're out of time now, are we?
No.
Do you want that, too?
I want it.
Yeah.
I said to us 2 years from a clock that burned to death, you know? It's a delightful architecture, this river of kingly color, an ocular delight, this stream of pure poetry, a vein aortic mix of spirit liquid that even evolves vampires overdose on blends of rich thick contradiction of unraveled breaths, expired, and even as muses, pilgrim seasoned muses, each leaves a trail of purple dripping from tongue and teeth, a new harvest of mystery, and even as scarved poets sip the mountain manna purple poem wine, dream drunk poets, pulse deafened, descend purply their seasoned lips. Thank you.